welcome back to part two of this series on Trotters for One podcast regarding marriage.
That's what brings us together today.
I'm Jonathan.
I'm Elizabeth.
And we like talking about marriage. We like talking about sex as well. We've written about that. That will probably be part three. So tune into that. This episode still might be PG-13. Make no promises. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
All right, yay. But before we do that, we have to talk about conflict, because conflict is such a huge part of any relationship.
And because part three can often lead to conflict.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. People typically argue the most about sex, money, and children. Mm-hmm. Or all of those things. Mm-hmm. Someone said the reason that people argue the most about those things is that's where people's biggest insecurities come out. That's where people's biggest fears come out, is sex, money, and children. So, yeah, so we'll definitely talk about sex in part three, of these episodes on marriage. But first, maybe about conflict. I mean, I don't know that we've ever had any.
Never.
Oh, my goodness. So, yes, we, like everybody else, have our fair share of conflict. And there are sometimes, as is normal, when we do not like each other. Mm-hmm. Does that happen?
That has happened.
Recently? Wait, don't answer that question. It does happen. It does happen. The thing is, conflict is not necessarily a bad thing. I was speaking to a group of 70 or so cross-cultural workers and asked them, what comes to mind when you hear the word conflict? And this was a very cross-cultural group, and almost everybody had these real negative conceptualizations of conflict. They said, oh, anger or loud or scary or bad. And this one lady stood up and said, when I hear the word conflict, I think opportunity. She was from Switzerland. And I kid you not, everybody laughed. And okay, that's par for the course. But one thing that's really helped me is to conceptualize conflict as coming from honesty. That if you want intimacy, on the far right, the goal is intimacy in any relationship, but in this context, marriage. If you really want intimacy, you're going to have honesty. Mm-hmm. But you can't have honesty for very long without having conflict.
Because we're different people.
Right, sure, yeah. And that's good. If you don't have any conflict at all, that scares me a lot. If I'm meeting with a premarital couple and they say they have zero conflict, then I say, okay, somebody is dying in the relationship. Mm. Who is that? Which one of you is dying? Because that's the only way to not have conflict. Mm-hmm. It's just completely be submerged in the other person. And that can look really holy and good for a little bit of time. But usually in the 30s or 40s, that starts to go away. You can't stay submerged forever, most people.
Yeah, I would say we get along really well in general, and a lot of our approaches to decision-making are very similar. Yeah. And so that makes it easy for us, kind of just, lottery or whatever. But we still have issues where sure. We have to work through things. So. Even if you are similar on a lot of points, you're still two different people, different needs, different histories, different dreams for the future.
Yeah.
Still going to have conflict.
Yeah. And that's okay, because intimacy requires honesty. Honesty will always lead at some point to conflict. The deal is, if you see conflict as this ginormous wall that is impenetrable, you'll be very scared of conflict. Or if in the past, conflict always looked dangerous, or maybe conflict always was dangerous for you in the past, then it makes sense that conflict with your spouse is really, really scary. So what we want to do today is kind of give a few tools to get around this giant wall, not to get around, to get through conflict. It's absolutely possible. Okay, sound mm-hmm. good?
Yeah.
So one of the most helpful things, I mentioned Gottman before, is his Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. That he talks about. These are things that when they're present in a relationship, sort of the more present they are, the more likely this relationship is unenjoyable. So the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, according to marriage researcher John Gottman, is criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. So when a conflict comes up, if one or both people start into one of these or multiple of these, criticism, contempt, defensiveness, or stonewalling, you're going to need to look for the antidotes of those things.
Can you define them?
Sure.
I think because a couple couple of them, I tend to get confused.
Okay, well, criticism is sort of attacking... I don't have it in front of me. Criticism, though, is attacking the sort of the behavior or... basically attacking the person and what they're doing.
Which is different from complaining.
Yeah, right, and we want to talk about the difference between criticizing and complaining. Actually, I teach people how to complain better all the time. because complaining well is actually a really crucial skill for relationship. So criticism is kind of attacking the person. Contempt is really this deeper feeling of superiority that I am attacking the character of the person. I am better. I really see myself as better than them.
And I can't see that as being good for any relationship.
No. The third one is defensiveness. It's kind of what it sounds like. It's just reacting to what the other person is saying defensively instead of listening to what they're saying. And then stonewalling is the classic, just sort of walking out of the room and closing the door. Or just totally shutting down and doing the cold silent treatment. So we all do these things to some extent. My default, if I'm not careful, is going to be criticism and contempt. Elizabeth, I know what yours are, but why don't you tell them what yours are?
Defensiveness and stonewalling.
Yeah, and it's almost always like that, where one person is more on the criticize contempt side and the other person is more on the stonewalling.
Because it's kind of like attack side. Versus... I mean, it is almost like opposites. Like, if you think low of someone else, if you're contemptuous of them, well, the opposite of that is defensiveness. Like, someone's like feels that attack and then they feel like they need to defend. But I will say I even stonewall God sometimes. Sure. So it's not just I'll be like, no, I'm not gonna talk to you for now. I suppose this also applies to our relationships with God too.
Yeah, sure does. Well, and people are afraid of conflict with God as well. Because they don't know that there's a way to get through that wall to intimacy on the other side. So we'll just go real theological here for just a second. If you cannot have conflict with God, you won't get to a deeper intimacy with God, so because you're not being honest with him. Yeah, it's the whole wrestling with God thing. So of course Gottman has written books and books about these four horsemen. I'll share some links to some more resources on that in the show notes, but the antidotes, I'm not sure how much we want to get into. Maybe we should.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. For the antidote to criticism is often to complain and to make I statements. So instead of criticizing you for your behavior, I am saying what it is that I need. So a classic example, if it's my son's job to take the trash out and he forgets, I could criticize him and attack him and say, dude, are you so lazy? Do you not even see the trash? It's your job to take the trash out. I can't believe you don't take the trash out. You know, what's the deal? Are you blind? That would be criticism and maybe bordering on contempt. Complaining, though, would be, hey, man, you know, we know it's your job to take the trash out, and I really need you to take the trash out. It smells more. We get more mice. We get more cockroaches when you don't take the trash out. So please take the trash out. That's a way of complaining, stating what it is that I need or even want in the relationship versus just criticizing and attacking.
Well, I feel like it's helpful even to say, I'm complaining right now. Oh, yeah. I'm going to, like, especially when you're maybe new to the difference between them. It's like, I'm practicing complaining right now. This is a behavior or a situation that I don't like. So that you're even like stating up front, I'm not trying to criticize you. I'm just trying to to complain about this
issue. I use that occasionally.
Yeah, yeah. And it's helpful for me, actually, because I'm like, okay, I can separate like the complaint from my person, my personhood and my character.
Yeah, and Sue Johnson in Creative for Connection, in the larger area called emotion-focused therapy, talks about the pursuer-withdrawer dynamic, where one person is usually pursuing for more connection. And if they don't get it, they are more likely to criticize or to protest. And the other person, who's maybe the withdrawer or the stonewaller, likely feels threatened or inadequate or judged and will withdraw. So again, it's reducing the threat if you're the pursuer and complaining and saying, this is something that I need, this is something that I want. That can be really hard for folks to do. That's part of a larger discussion, of course.
But something really interesting about that pursuer distancer or pursuer withdrawer thing that is that every couple, since you're two unique individuals, as we discussed earlier, you're going to have a different need for intimacy or closeness. So you could have a very close, your match could be almost the same, but you're still not going to be exact. So you'll still have this distancer, pursuer relationship going on.
Hmm.
Even if you both want intimacy and you both want it a lot, you'll still maybe have one person who wants it more. So that really was helpful for me to understand.
Yeah.
This is going to happen in every single relationship. It could be very mismatched where one person wants a lot of intimacy and the other person doesn't want any at all. And so then there's this huge mismatch. But even with just a very small mismatch, you'll still have it happening.
Yeah, that's true. So the antidote for contempt is gratefulness. That is spending some time considering what is it that I appreciate about this person? What is it that I really love about this person? And keeping that in mind. There's a lot of research, secular, and there's a lot of reasons theologically that this works. But I just think it's fascinating when secular research backs up the idea, the ideas that are in the Bible.
Yeah.
So this is something that's really helped me, honestly, is at one point a few years ago, I downloaded a gratefulness app and started being like, okay, this is what I am grateful for. That helps. It is the antidote to contempt.
And I think, you're not just talking about contempt towards your partner. You're talking about contempt towards anyone, right?
Well, sure. Specifically towards you, but... But yeah, these things do overlap into relationships with other people, for sure.
But I think it's worth noting, what are the biblical ideas behind this contempt thing? And obviously, it would be things along the lines of pride and humility. So if you think you're better than someone... Or if you can actually see that God loves everyone the same and he made us all in his image, and to treat the other person as an image of God, that's kind of the, I think, the theological underpinnings of this.
Yeah, yeah. So, that's good. We're still talking about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. These are ideas developed and researched by John Gottman. The third one is defensiveness. And the antidote to defensiveness is owning your part of it, whatever is your part. That might be a little bit, it might be a lot, but just recognizing that you're feeling threatened. But if there is part of it that you can own it.
That's a humility issue also.
Sure. The fourth one is stonewalling. That's just a withdrawal, would be another word for it. And the antidote to that involves self-soothing. It involves saying, okay, what is the fear that's happening that's causing the person to run away? Is it a fear of intimacy, or is it a feeling threatened? Is it feeling inadequate or feeling judged? You look inquisitive.
Well, isn't this where, sometimes if you're having a conversation and,
flooded.
Flooded is the word that I'm thinking about, yeah.
So this concept's been very helpful for a lot of folks, including us. Gottman actually got people together in a lab and hooked them up to equipment that measured heart rate and blood pressure and stuff, and then asked them to talk about something that was a little bit, uneasy between them. And what he noticed is that occasionally one or both people would become physiologically flooded. That is where their heart rate goes up, their blood pressure goes up, their sort of fight or flight hormones go up. And what his research showed that once one person is physiologically flooded, the possibility of that conversation ending well or ending in a healthy spot plummets. It's just almost nil. And so what he recommends, and which I think is a great idea, is that whoever's feeling flooded, they got to recognize, okay, I am feeling flooded, and then own it. And then take a break. And this is different than walking out of the room and slamming the door. Taking a break is something like, okay, I'm feeling really flooded right now. This is a really important conversation to me, and I think we need to come back to it. Can we come back to it tomorrow after breakfast? Or can we come back to it in an hour after I go for a walk?
Oh, yes, because the timing is important, right?
Yeah, most people think that they can go back to baseline in like 5 minutes. But if someone is physiologically flooded, where their heart rate's up, their, you know, this whatever is going on, it actually takes their body 20 to 30 minutes to come back to baseline. So
we did this like a month ago.
But yeah, it's really, really helpful. because if you keep going, it's just very unlikely to cause good outcomes. So,
and recognizing it sooner rather than earlier is a skill. Sooner rather than earlier? Sooner rather than later is a skill.
Yeah.
Because I think I tend to just like put up with whatever's going on inside me, like ignore it. And then all of a sudden, like it gets over that kind of like the glass is full, it's like spilling out. And then I'm not okay at all. But yeah, on this particular situation, we were having a conversation and I just said, okay, I can't do this anymore. It's too much. We need to do this later. So
she uses this research against me sometimes. And once she says, okay, I'm feeling flooded, then I'm like, okay, yeah, that's right.
But
I got
to
back off.
You have to pay attention to yourself. And that is definitely takes practice. Yeah.
And so it's so recognizing flooding, being flooded is so different than just storming out. Because you're emphasizing to your partner, I care about you and I care about this relationship. I just can't keep going right now. But it's so important to me that we need to talk about it sometime. And sometimes I think Christians have this tendency. We're like, oh, we're not supposed to go to bed angry. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we have to hash it out until 2 a.m. and argue it out. And that's just really not a good idea. Mm-hmm. Because you can actually say, you know what? Okay, we're at an impasse. I don't feel, you know, a whole lot of warmth towards you right now, but this is important to me. Let's take a break. Let's come back to it. I think you're still following the scriptural mandate there. You're just not hashing it out until 2 a.m. And you're still addressing it by saying, all right, let's come back to it after the kids are in bed, or let's come back to it, you know, tomorrow over lunch or whatever.
Like I personally don't, I tend to not make any sense after a certain time of night. And
so true.
And so I don't understand what he's saying. I'm not even sure I understand what I'm saying. And the morning is always better. I mean, God's word says that his mercies are new every morning. And for me in my life, that's been true. Even if I do nothing to get better, most of the time in the morning, it is better. So when the sun comes back up,
what you can't
make
do,
more sense.
What you cannot do is use flooding as an excuse to never talk about it. To say, oh, I'm just feeling flooded. I need to go away. That's not how this works. That will result probably in your partner feeling abandoned and you actually never having the conversation. So I would say if you keep trying and coming back to it the next day or in an hour and it really is a challenge and you cannot have the conversation without somebody getting flooded and that happens over and over and over, that's probably time to call in somebody else who may be able to walk you through it, whether it's a counselor or a pastor or someone who's not going to take sides, but who's going to walk you through the dynamic of seeing why is this so threatening and how do you have this conversation in a healthy way? So those are the four horsemen and this concept of flooding.
So let's say
super,
them.
Super helpful.
Oh.
criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. And again, remember, honesty is necessary for intimacy. But if you are honest for very long, you will have conflict. That's not a problem if you have some pathways through the conflict. And these antidotes to the four horsemen provide some pathways through through the conflict on the path towards intimacy. All right? Make sense?
Yeah.
So maybe maybe we talk about one of the more questions, one question that we got from a reader, and then we'll kind of wrap up. We'll talk about that for a minute and then wrap up this
episode. What's it called?
Part two. All right, let me pull up these questions from readers. Which one were we going to do? The one on...
Well, there was one about decision making and one about working side by side. They were kind of...
Let's do side by side.
Okay.
So the question is, what have you learned about working side by side in not only family and ministry life, but also career and work life, like in our podcasts, our writings together, while you both have unique and different personalities and giftings?
That person is very astute.
Yeah, it's a really good question because we have found ourselves in this place where we're actually doing a lot of ministry together while at the same time being very different. Mm-hmm. One example of our differences, you know, we both write on A Life Overseas. Elizabeth is the editor-in-chief of that, so she's my boss. But we write very differently, different styles, but the process of writing is also very different. I will get a really rough draft and want her to read it immediately because I want her feedback immediately. It's like, I just did something. Here, check it out. What do you think? And she'll be like, oh my goodness, there's periods are everywhere. You need commas. I'm like, okay, that's fine. Where Elizabeth won't want me to even, you know, smell anything she's written until she's gone through it 1,000 times and is giving it to me in sort of a final form. Yeah. So, yeah.
And we also, we have very different styles of communicating. So not like right or wrong, but like, it used to be like I would read something that he'd written and I'd be like, well, I wouldn't say it that way. That's not how I would say it. You should say it a different way.
I'd be like, I want to say it that way.
But he also would read mine and be like, you shouldn't say it that way. But that's the way I wanted to say it. So we've just learned, and we might point it out and say, well, that's an interesting way of saying that. Is that how you want to say it? But if it's how the other person wants to say it, then we're like, okay. But it took a while to get there.
Yeah, it did. Honestly, I think I had to get to a spot where I really recognized that Elizabeth's qualities were different than mine, but they were still qualities. That the way she approached people, the way her brain works is so, so different. And initially, that really rubbed me the wrong way because I thought that that meant bad.
Wrong.
The way, yeah, bad and wrong. And the way that she had conversations with people. I mean, I was just a jerk sometimes and be like, you just did that conversation all wrong. And I realized over time, I would watch people react to her writings, or I would watch people react to her in conversations, and I would realize, well, she's able to connect with people in a way that I just can't. But at the same time, there are ways that I can connect with people or see people that she can't. And so for me, to answer the question, well, how do we, you know, work alongside of each other in kind of the same things, even though we're different. For me, the big thing was recognizing that that difference can actually be a tremendous strength. And I just had to realize that Elizabeth had very different qualities, but those were also strengths.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if the person asking was a woman or a man, but I've gotten questions similar to this from a lot of women. I think this tends to be more of a women's issue of like, I don't feel good enough for my partner, for my husband. They have these big, like, outside the house skills and talents and ministries, because women still tend to be more taking care of the house. And so even if you had a ministry before children or before living cross-culturally, because let's face it, somebody still has to do the laundry and the dishes and the cooking and cleaning. Even if you don't have children, and who's going to do that? And a lot of times, sometimes we share, but sometimes it also falls more to the woman. And so she feels more at home and feels like her gifts are sidelined or not appreciated. And, like she'll never measure up to her husband. And sometimes her husband may be saying things like this, but sometimes he's not. It's just this feeling that we get. And, I think that this question that was asked is addressing really fundamental issues of, am I good enough for you? Like if it was husband and wife face to face talking about like, okay, we're different, we do things differently, but saying, am I good enough for you? Will you love me for always, even if I'm different? Can I trust you to believe in me, to believe in my dreams? Can I trust you to value me and cherish me? So that gets at really, really deep insecurities. I mean, it can come from the man, too. We can all have insecurities about our value and everything. So that's why I think that this question that was asked is not just about techniques or something, but it's about the deeper questions of, am I good enough? And those questions have to be asked to God, but also with your spouse, kind of agreeing together to look at each other's value, even if you have different types of skills.
Yeah. It's important to note, I think, that, you know, when we first started writing together, we started fighting together a lot.
A lot. For like a year.
Because it was impinging on some of your sense of ownership of this one area that you felt like you were good in, and then I started writing too. I mean, our family website, trottersforone.com, almost got completely erased during one of those fights.
Let's just take it all down
is what the conversation was. And by the grace of God and just some ongoing patience on both parts, I think it's really a fun thing that we share together now, but it was not always mm-hmm. like that. Yeah.
So we have a lot of compassion on couples who are like still in the middle of that. And we will post our, we'll post the things we've written about that in the show notes.
So one of the articles was Jesus Loves Me, This I Sometimes Know.
Yeah.
Where you were kind of processing your journey in that.
Yeah.
What other?
Well, I wrote about when marriage and ministry collide, which was about how we did ministry in the States. I'm trying to think. There might be another one, but we'll link them all in the show notes because it's a really tricky thing. If you feel like your ministry is less than the other person's, or if it's not valued by your spouse, or by God, or by people around you, and then you have to ask all these questions about, like, where does my worth really come from, and is it from what I do, is it from, you know, all those things.
So there's small
very,
things like that.
Very big questions. So I think that's why the question that that person wrote in with is, it's such a big question, and it is going to involve a lot of self-reflection and a lot of talking with your spouse. It's way bigger than, oh, these are the things, like, to do, these are the 5 magic steps.
Yeah. So we're going to wrap up here from our car by the pond in Missouri. Hopefully it's not too loud for you guys. We're doing the best we can to get the best sound quality. But I want to just mention one other tool that I use all the time that sort of incorporates all these ideas. I learned the basic structure of this from a counselor we went to in Colorado years ago named John Regeer. I renamed it. I call it how I do it, the Vortex of Terror. Basically, this cycle that people get on when their insecurities are tweaked. How do they respond? That's kind of typically where the four horsemen come into play. And then how do you sort of care across? How do you connect with the heart of your spouse? So I'll put that in the show notes. It's like a 7-8 minute video kind of walking through the Vortex of Terror. And we'll see you guys next time for part 3. Where we'll talk about sex and stuff like that. So definitely do not have your kids or your mother-in-law around for that. And we're going to answer a question we got from someone who was saying, okay, how do you deal with intimacy, with sexuality, when you have small kids and you're on a home assignment and like sharing rooms or in other people's homes and that kind of stuff? So that's a very difficult question that's really worth taking a stab at. Mm-hmm. So we'll try that. We'll talk about some other sex books and resources that we have come across in part 3. See you later.
Bye.